Before we begin, let us bring our palms together then to make our deepest veneration to the Buddha. Let us remind ourselves that as we make this mark of veneration, it is not a mere token of our respect or devotion, but rather it is a pledge of our allegiance to the Buddha, which represents the truth, the Dhamma, which is the teaching and the Sangha, our practice. So with that in mind, let us pay our homage to the Noble Triple Gem, seek refuge and observe the precepts. We will then invite the countless sentient beings to join us and be amongst us and witness his meritorious deed. We do that with compassion and loving kindness, and then we will make a start to today's sermon. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Towards the end of last week's talk, we spent some time talking about how scientists see and perceive the world, how the average individual perceives the world, and how what is the Buddhist perspective of the world, how an Aryan should perceive the world. I want to talk about that again, because it's very important that we understand that it's not a different world we strive to look at or to see. It's the same world, but with a different perspective, a different lens. This is the switch between sight and insight. We always look at the same thing. It's our perspective that changes with our understanding. And if you can equip yourself with this perspective, with this insight, it is something that you can take away and apply across every experience in your life, ladies and gentlemen. True that for the purpose of these discussions, I might take material things, objects, and give you examples. I might bring a cup one day or a pen, some other material object. But I think you understand that these are mere examples. And the truth applies across the board to everything. So today what I want to do is to go over what we discussed towards the latter part of last week's talk, and then talk about its relevance to you as you live your day-to-day lives, particularly the fact that expectations that arise in the mind, I want to show you that expectations arise in the mind due to a lack of understanding of this principle. So, to acquire this understanding will help you to come out of this mindset where you set expectations on things that you interact with, people that you interact with, situations, events that you interact with, and therefore end up suffering. Wherever you suffer, I think this is the very first and most important thing to understand, and I'm sure none of you deny this, wherever you suffer, it is because of an expectation. I don't think you've ever suffered where you've not set an expectation on something or someone. So much so that to say that expectation is synonymous with suffering is not an understatement. Be that at home, with your family, at the workplace, with colleagues, or even with yourself. Sometimes there are you set expectations upon yourselves. And when those expectations aren't met, you are disappointed. And these disappointments come in various shapes and sizes and flavors. But after all, what's common across all unsatisfactoriness is a disappointment, is an expectation that hasn't been met. So what typically happens is when we live our lives, we find ourselves in three states. The first is in a state of expectation, expecting that what you want to happen will happen. So right at that point, it's undecided which way it's going to go. But you have the expectation nonetheless. Half of these will materialize. And the other half won't. I'm not saying it's exactly half and half, but you get the idea. So you're in one of these three states pretty much all of the time. Either you're expecting something to happen, or whatever it is you've expected has happened, or you've just come to the realization that your expectations have just been dissed, and therefore it's a disappointment. So it's always one of these three states. You want me to give you examples, or you have plenty of them? Really? You're looking for me for examples? What is life? The three of these, right? Time and time again, every day, this is what you go through. When you put the rice in the cooker, you expect it to come out well cooked. But there are those days where it doesn't. It's either overcooked or undercooked. But if it's cooked just fine, so it's one of those three states. These states are what we call raga, dvesha and moha. This is why arahants don't have these three states. Delusion, desire and aversion, which is the same in Pali. Moha, raga and dvesha. All languages will have the equivalence. So even in Sinhalese, we typically refer to this as moha, raga, dvesha. You've heard this, right? These are three things that arahants don't have. So why are you not an arahant yet? Because you can say we are proud to say that we have things that even arahants don't have. So don't think any less of yourself, because you have stuff that even arahants don't have. How lucky you are. So in other terms, I would say that these are expectations, to put it in lay terms. These are when expectations are unfulfilled. And then, of course, on the other side, fulfilled expectations. So you understand that to have these two, you have to have this. If this is the root, then these are branches. When you say that you are in a happy state, you're in a good mood, you're happy, what do you think you're referring to? Which state? Yes. When you say that you're unhappy, what state do you think you're referring to? That. This is how these states come to experience. This is when it becomes an experience for you. The state of moha is a state of, it's an unsettled state. It's a state of vexation. You've heard the word vexation. We talk about it a lot. Pretty much all our sermons we talk about vexation. The Sinhalese term for this we use quite often is pidav. Pidav. It's not stress, it's vexation. You're unsettled. So this is kind of like Christmas Eve. The eve of Christmas. Why do I say that it is the eve of Christmas? Expectations, yes. The expectation of the following day. Because you see all those gifts wrapped nicely under the tree. Can you touch them? You can touch, but what can't you do? You can't open them. The best you can do is take it, shake it, and hope you don't break what's in it. So you're very gentle, because you can't open it. That day is the following day, the day of opening. The big revelation comes the following day. But until then, you have to, all you can do is, as I say, you can look, but don't touch. So that's where you have to draw the line. So that's a day of moha. It's like the day before your birthday. Why? Because surprises are planned. How do you know it's a surprise? Because you expect it. See, you expect it, don't you? You expect something special to come to you on your birthday, but no one's talking about it. No one's saying a word. People are pretending like they've forgotten it. Doesn't that all add to the mystery of it? When everyone's like pretending, what? Tomorrow we are going out, right? Tomorrow? Why? What's tomorrow? So everyone at home is pretending like, what? Tomorrow? It's just an average, ordinary day. What's so special about tomorrow? And it's worse when it's the anniversary, isn't it? Because you now fear that your other half has forgotten that it's your anniversary. Birthdays are okay, you know, you've had many of them, that many missed, forgotten birthdays that once you reach 45, 50, you're kind of like forgiven society for it. But anniversaries are not like that, because you are supposed to be special to at least one person. At least one person must consider you special. And if that person has also forgotten that you are special in some way, then what's the point of living? You lose the will to live after that. So these are very common experiences in our lives. This is once you've submitted your exam sheets and waiting for results. Or this is when you're on the browser, hitting F5 and putting your index number, hoping that you're going to get a good grade. This is after you bought the lottery, but they haven't played the numbers yet. What else? This is when you're out driving on the streets, but you haven't had an accident yet. But you're out driving until you get home. In one piece, unscathed. This is that. Don't consider this to be joy. It's not joy. That is why this is joy. Just think about it. Every time you experience a sense of joy, satisfaction, fulfillment, right? A sense of relief, remind yourself that the only reason you feel that now or at that time is because you were in a state of dissatisfaction, state of vexation, at least for a moment before that. Therefore, it's never something to be really joyful about. It's kind of like the rash. You get a rash on your body, that's that state of moha. Because what are you tempted to do now? Scratch yourself, right? So when you're scratching it, you feels good. Is that something to be really happy about? Why not? Feels good. Why is that not something to be really happy about? Because you've got a rash. You've got a blooming rash on your body. How could you be happy about that? Therefore, there are many rashes in your life. This is that day before they announce this year's performance bonuses. The day before. So the following day they send out the notices to the management, HR, they send you the letter to say this is your performance bonus for this year or your rating, end of year rating. Familiar with what I'm talking about? End of year ratings? You know what I'm talking about. I used to have get them, I'm free from them now. I don't know, man, why you people go through this. When life can be so free, so relaxed and so content, why you put yourself through this mill? This is a mill. So I can give you plenty of examples for this. It's that moment before, you know, you're driving on the street and the vehicle comes really close up to you. It's that moment. It's that moment when you want to just pass the traffic lights and you can see it's gone amber. Next it's going to go red. But there's that moment of hope. I can do this. Right? Then you put your foot on the metal to try and get across that. Get across the line, but you also know that there's a camera. That makes things worse. But it's that moment of excitement. You call it excitement. People call it the thrill of life. But if all there was this, I mean, you know, fortunately you have relief from this. That is the only reason people put themselves through this. Just imagine if there was only the stress, only the vexation, only that so-called thrill. I don't think it would be thrill. I doubt you will actually call it thrill. It would be torture. If every day was Christmas Eve, would you like that? So you can always look at the presents, but you can't ever open them. So this is that time when there's a girl you like and you want to ask her out. You're picking up the courage to walk up to her and ask her. It's that. Typically, where do you spend most of your time? Up here, or down here? What do you think? It's down here. Yeah, it's down here. You spend most of your time, most of your life, in a state of moha. Because this branching out happens momentarily. It's in a moment it happens. You're in a state of moha, and then typically it builds up. Because that's where you're thinking, you're planning, you're preparing. That's a lot of the time you spend here. And then at one moment, you execute. And that execution can either turn out to be, in your world, a success, or it could be a failure. Where it turns out to be a success, that's when you have relief from this expectation. The problem is, ladies and gentlemen, when people find this relief, they don't recognize that it's merely a relief from that expectation, from that vexation. That people tend to forget. Not forget, they don't understand. I think it's not about forgetting, but they just don't understand that. Therefore, they look forward to the next one. See, there's only one way you can experience this raga or this desire or this joy, and that is to keep looping around this. Once you've scratched yourself, that rash I'm talking about again, yes, it feels good. But then for it to feel good again, what must you continue to have? The same rash, you have to have that itch. You don't like the itch, but you like the feeling that you get when you scratch it. So how can you have this without this? How could you? You can't have this without this. They come as a package. You can't have Christmas without Christmas Eve. You can't have your birthday surprise without the day before your birthday. You can't have the, hey, surprise without the building up of that surprise. Even if it's momentary. When someone says, surprise, In that moment, perhaps, you know, you didn't even know that there was something was planned for you. Maybe, say, at the workplace. You really didn't know that something was planned for you. But in a split moment, when they say, surprise, and you go into emotion overload, in that moment, you feel really good about yourself because you're constantly in a state of need for recognition. You like it. You like it when you're recognized. You like it when you're acknowledged. So that is a state of mind you are constantly in. That's why these momentary experiences of surprise, like when it's not pre-planned, it still feels good, right? I get this question sometimes asked of me. Swaminathan, we know, like, okay, when there's something planned and you have to build up for it, it makes sense. Okay, it feels good. But what about those moments where it comes, you know, out of nowhere and something's given, a gift is given to you when you weren't expecting it at all? So then how come you have this joy? Where's the relief from vexation then? Well, the relief is the vexation was the vexation for recognition, for acknowledgement, for someone to value me, oneself. And when do you have that? On Sundays. Then? All the time. You have it all the time. It's just incessant. It's always there. The need for recognition, the need for acknowledgement, the need for valued, to be valued. It's always there. Because it's always there, whenever someone gives you a surprise, you know that it's at a moment where they make you feel special. So you like it. That's where you feel this relief. See, these are emotions that Ratanvanses don't go through. Because they're always at rest. They don't have these waves. They're like a lake, but placid. Unlike the oceans that people typically are. Waves crashing all the time. That's why there's a lot of noise when you walk up down the beach, up and down the beach, you look at the sea. It's always a lot of noise, right? Waves crashing and all sorts. Typically people are very noisy. Rahatanvan says, placid. They're at rest, they're tranquil. Although you might be able to pretend that you are tranquil, in your mind there's so much going on because you're always in one of these three states. There's never a moment, ladies and gentlemen, that you can be free of one of these three states. Even in your sleep, you're in one of these three states. Have you never had nightmares? So which state are you in then? You're in this dvesha. Haven't you had sweet dreams? Which state are you in then? Raga. And while you're asleep, still not in that dream state, you're in moha. So you're constantly in one of these three states. That's why the Buddha says, none of these three are anything to be proud of, happy about, write home about. These are all diseases of the mind. Moha is a disease of the mind. This is the rash of the mind. This is when you scratch that rash. This is when you can't do it. You can't scratch it because perhaps your arm is tied. Imagine that. There's a rash up here and the other arm is tied behind you. You can't rub it against anything either. Assume that. Now. So this just keeps on building up. And there's no hope now of relief. It's that experience. Like I said, it's the day where you had your birthday, but there are no presents. So it's now 11:59. There's only another minute to go before the following day, 12 o'clock, right? End of birthday. People have forgotten. It's what you feel at that time. Hope's lost. Lost hope. It's when you get that letter to say your performance rating is whatever it is, and it's below your expectation. Therefore, you get no bonus this year. It's that. This is what desha is. It's when you go and ask that girl out and she says, sorry, I'm taken. Oh, it's not you, it's me. But you're just not my type. It's that. those moments. It's when you feel your stomach roiling and you feel your heart sink. It's those moments you feel like, why me? These are those moments where you ask yourself that question, why me? It's when they play the numbers and you look at your lottery ticket and none of the numbers match. It's that moment. You've not had that experience? Is it? Typically Mother's Day falls on a Sunday for some reason. Yeah, I remember even, I think it was last year as well, it fell on a Sunday. Yeah, so this is the gift, Mother's Day is gift. So why is Mother's Day special? Who is it more special to? Mothers or the children? The mothers. Because you've been looking forward for 364 days in the hope that they will recognize you, acknowledge you. And there's Father's Day. When is Father's Day? Do we know? Do we care? It's just fathers. Yes, we're fathers. Mother's Day, yes, of course, right? If you don't recognize that, then you're in for trouble. But fathers, who cares about fathers? So, you know, whatever the reason, whatever it is, everyone's in one of these three states. You know, this is like the shopkeeper waiting for the next customer. They're waiting until the next customer shows up. Imagine you run a showroom. You're selling cars, sofas, what, pets, whatever it is, right? Customer walks in through the door. Now you're still in a state of vexation. This is moha, state of moha. Will they buy something or won't they? So now they start having that conversation. So they start asking about various things in the store. Like, how much is this? Oh, this is nice. Oh, I like it. Nice color. So you're hoping, okay, buy it. And if you like it, buy the thing. And you do this to shopkeepers all the time, don't you? You walk into shops and you tease them. Don't you tease your shop, the salesman in the shops? You just go and touch things, you know. Nice fabric. Huh? You never buy it though. And you, in your mind, you know you're not going to buy it. You just want to tease them. So at that time, you know, they're in a state of moha, expectation. They're in that state, hoping that you will buy it. So you say, can I fit it on, please? Now it's moving closer in that direction. It's moving in that direction. Oh, she wants to fit it on. Right, today we are talking. Looking like we're going to get some business. So you cannot pick like 300 things and take it to the fitting room. I know you're not allowed that many, right? Fortunately. How many? Three? Five? Five. Okay. I can't remember. And being a typical bloke, even when I used to go shopping, that one. Took it to the fit-on room. Yep, works. Okay, let's go home. That's how I used to be. Until I got married. Anyway. All right, anyhow, moving swiftly on. So you can only take five, right? So you take that five, put into a basket or something, take it in. Now the shopkeeper outside, because they're planning their holiday, hoping that you will come back out of that fit-on room with good news. Right? So they're waiting for good news. So you walk back out with all of them. He or she is looking at your face with hope. Yes, yes, please say you want all five of them. And then they say, yeah, I'll go have a look and come back again. I'll come back again. Now, what are they supposed to do? keep their smile on. Yeah? They're supposed to keep their smile on. You think they're really smiling at that time? You think that's a genuine smile when they say, "It's okay, sir, it's fine, sir." If you could really read their mind, they're not saying it's fine, sir. They're saying something else, sir. I won't tell you what it is they're saying, but if you try read their mind, you will work it out. You won't do that again after you hear them say that, or after you hear them think that. Some people, they spend like half an hour, right, picking things but never buying anything. So these are those moments where you leave them in states of moha. But if you walk up to the store and then say, "Yeah, I'll have this, this, that and that. Right, can you ring them up for me, please?" Now the smile goes on. And then they walk you to the counter. As if, you know, they give their number. If that's how they are, like, what do you call it? What's it called? Donation?
Commission.
Commission, yes, yes. That's how they get their commission. So they give their staff number, whatnot. Right? So then they ring it up and say, this much. And then say they reach out, you reach out for your wallet and say, "Sorry, I haven't brought my card with me." What happens then? So they were in raga. They were in raga when you said, "I'll have all five of them." Then it goes to desha, because it's back to moha. The moment you're looking around trying to find your card, right? And you say, "Oops, oops." Very easy to say, "Oops." But it's very, very difficult to stomach when they hear you say that. So they're back in moha as you're trying to locate your cash or your card or your wallet, your purse. But the moment you say, "Yikes, I've forgotten it, couldn't bring it. I'll go back home and grab it." Then go to dvesha. But what should they still do? Smile. And say what? "Oh, it's perfectly fine. No, didn't break a sweat. Don't worry about it. But as you leave, you know what the two of them are talking between themselves? Don't turn around. Trust me, in those situations, don't turn around, because you might hear things or you might see them mumble things and you might never walk back into that store again. It's difficult. Really is. Sales is a very difficult job. You have to hide all of your emotions. You can't be free. You can't show who you really are. What's going through inside, you have to bottle it all up and hide it all and cover it all up. You just can't show who you are inside. See, this is just one experience, one example of how that happens. And then other times, let's say you bought something, right? Assume you bought something. You bring it home and you don't like it. Can't it happen? Of course. Perhaps it's a gift to someone, or you just don't like it more. It doesn't stretch as much as you thought it would. Then what do you want to do? Return. Yes. So now when you come to this conclusion, "I have to return this," what state are you in? Moha, of course. You're now in moha again. Why? That's an expectation. Who knows whether they might accept, take it back or not? So now who's the one who's got to do all the smiling? So a moment ago at the store, when you were the one who was doing the buying, when you were the buyer, you could put all your, you know, put on your, like, what do you call it? Your airs, yes. You could put on all your airs and show that, you know, you were the customer and be the customer. Like, "I'm always right," and you didn't have to smile, no niceties, none of that. You could just be as rude as you want to be. Well, within reason. Sometimes they kick you out. But the shopkeeper has to be nice to you. But now when you want to return something, now the tables have turned. Now who has to be nice? Now you have to be nice. So then you walk back into the store with your merchandise because you want to return it now. You are in a state of expectation. This is mohana. So then you go and you talk to them. Hello, nice to see you again. I wonder whether you could do me a favor. Would you be a darling? Yeah. So I bought this just the other day, and it's just it's a problem with this. It doesn't stretch enough. I used to try and say what's not so good about it, and as you say that, what do you want the shopkeeper to do? You're trying to convince them that they have to take it back. What do you want them to say? You want them to say? You want them? Yeah, it's fine. You can return it. So you're hopeful. You're hopeful that that is the response you're going to get back from them. But do you see how it could go one of two ways? If they refuse your request, where are you now? Desha. Then the next request is, can I talk to them? You know the drill, don't you? Can I talk to the manager, please? Because first you try it nicely. If that doesn't work, then sternly. So can I talk to the manager, please? Then the manager comes. Then again you try to put on that nice face with the manager to try and convince the manager that you're such a saint. And it was just a mistake, right? Could have happened to anyone. But you're very nice, you're very polite, you're the world's best customer. You should be given the world's best customer award. That's the kind of how you present yourself at that time. Again, you're back in moha. Now you're with the manager. You're back in moha because you were at dvesha before because the shopkeeper or the salesman said no, refused. Now back with the shopkeeper. Sorry, back with the manager. You're back in moha again. So now once again, it could go one of two ways, couldn't it? So then the manager says, well, what do you want, sir? Madam, he asks. He's like, I want my money back. Then they say, I'll be a brief moment, please. And then they walk back into the office. What are you again? Still in moha. Well, that's processing. Whenever anything is processing, on your computer, when everything is processing, what are you in that? What state are you in? Moha. Buffering? Moha. Loading? Moha. Always in a state of moha. That's why I say, this is where you spend most of your time. This is the greatest disease of all. But because we are always expecting that, we have our sights set on something, a moment of joy, we tend to forget that we are in this lurch, in this pit of suffering. We tend to forget that. It's like when you're in a deep, dark pit, but you're looking up and you can see the sun. You can see a way out. You forget where you are. That's what happens. Because your focus is on something positive. You forget that you're already in a pretty bad state. That's what it is. It's like when you're at the hospital. You always ask the doctors, what is the prognosis? When can I be out? And the doctor says, well, we'll discharge you in another 3 or 4 days' time. So then they give you hope. That's why they say, hope keeps you alive. And these positive thinkers, they're always talking about this stuff. I used to do the same. I'm guilty of it myself. I always talk about positive, positive, positive. Looking at the bright side. Be positive. I mean, even today I say such things, but the thing is, to look at the positive side, where are you at that time? You're in a problem. You're in a problem. Otherwise, why must you look at the positive side? Why must you particularly look at the positive side unless you're already in a problem? Right? Because if you are not in a problem, then there's nothing to look at the positive side. You're already positive. So the fact that you have to look at the positive side, you have to try and be positive, is because you're in a problem. Therefore, that's the analogy I can offer you. You're in a pit. It's a deep, dark pit. But you're trying to look up and you see the sun. You see that there's a way out. There's a way out of this. And that keeps your hopes high. Makes you feel like you're already there. That's what jati does to you. When you see a solution to a problem, jati, as in these defilements that you have in your mind, ignorance in your mind, makes you feel like you're already there. That's why when you walk up, like I said earlier, you want to walk up and ask a girl out. In your mind, what are you thinking? She'll say yes, or he'll say yes. Otherwise you wouldn't walk up to them. You wouldn't ask them. So you live in the joy of that future moment, which hasn't even arrived yet. Which hasn't arrived yet. But that is why we call it an expectation. It hasn't arrived. But you still experience that promised joy. A little bit of that. It's like a fragment of that. You experience it because your mind can cook up a story. Because your mind is really great at bringing to the present moment experiences of the future. If I had a slice of cake in my hand, why do you start salivating? What is your mind doing? Exactly. It's bringing to the present moment an experience from the future. That's how your mouth starts salivating when you look at something or see something delicious, something you think is delicious, because that deliciousness is something the mind cooks up. Deliciousness is not in the food. You know this. And that's a really good piece of evidence to convince you that deliciousness is not in the food. The fact that you can salivate even without your tongue coming into contact with the food, you're already salivating. How come? Because deliciousness has already been contrived in your mind. But even when you eat it, still, if you think it's delicious, it's again still a fabrication of the mind. It's not something that comes from the food. So when you think that something's going to be delicious, when you think of this prospective positive, this potential positive, jati makes you live in that moment. Not in this moment, but in the moment of that joy, that promised hope, that promised goodness, promised joy. And that is really dangerous. Because it really hides the truth of the moment, the fact that you're already in a problem. As I said, the patient who's in the ward, he's in the hospital, and the doctor says, in 3 days' time you'll be discharged. Now that 3 days is something he can look forward to. That looking forward to makes it okay. He finds that agreeable. Now he can live with that. But if the doctor did say, not sure yet, we'll see. That makes it very difficult. The physical pain is not what they can't bear. It's not knowing when they can come out of the problem. That's unbearable. Just imagine this, right? Imagine there were prison sentences, but indefinite. I don't mean a life sentence where you're there for the rest of your life. I mean the judge says you're going to be sent to prison, but I'm not going to tell you for how long. Just imagine that. You're going to be in prison, but I'm not going to tell you for how long. It's not the prison sentence that's going to give you grief. It's not knowing for how long, because you can't see now in your mind, you can't see a day out. You can't see that future raga. The day of relief, you can't envisage that. That is torture. That's why people commit suicide. When they can't see a way out. Because typically if you give them a solution, and you know that you can achieve that in a few days, in a few weeks, maybe in a year or two, right? They can settle then. But when that day cannot be seen, cannot be imagined, cannot be envisaged, now they don't see a way out. That's what happens. When people are indebted, and just the burden of debt is just too much, it's okay for as long as they have a recovery plan. If you give them a recovery plan, in this time you can pay this much of it off, and then the remainder of it you can pay it in installments, and say in this many months, weeks, years, you can be free of debt, not to worry. That's very settling. That's okay, that's acceptable, that's manageable. But we can't see that. When you don't know when there's ever going to be a way out of this, that's torture. It's torturous, that is. Because that's when you're in a state of dvesha. Either when you have no hope of coming out of it, because all hope has been lost, all paths to relief have been severed, nothing, no other path exists, then you're left here. And that's excruciating. That's why death is excruciating. The pain of death, the death of a loved one. Because you know what? They're never coming back. That's why it's so painful. Because your mind is now in dvesha. But you can be away from the same person for a few years. That's okay. You can bear that. But it's the same effect, isn't it? Imagine you can make zero contact with the person, right? Because you're going to some other country. It's a complete dead zone. No communications, no telecommunications, and you're going to have to be there for the next 5 years. That is bearable than to say that someone's going to be dead. Because after that 5 years, you see, I'm going to be reunited with that individual, so I can get that experience back. You can live in moha, but when it comes to dvesha, when you know that it's no longer achievable, it's not possible, then it's very, very, very painful. Because you know there's no hope anymore. But what I'm saying is, this is where people spend most of their lives, in moha. And because we do it so much of the time, so often, it has now become second nature to us. We have become so used to being in a state of moha. It's like carrying your own body weight. Are you not heavy? I mean, not in a bad way, but aren't you heavy? I mean, you're constantly carrying at least, what, 60, 70 kilos, right? On average, you're at least carrying that much weight. If I gave you 60 kilos to carry on your hands, would you? Put 60 to a side. If I gave you 10 kilos to carry on your hand, would you, on your arms? You wouldn't. So how come you're carrying 60? And you're okay with that? Because you're used to it now. And they didn't give all of it at once. They gave it little by little. Because when you were born, you didn't have to carry much of your weight at all. And then you started growing. Little by little, it became manageable. Whereas if you were born 60, it would not have been so comfortable. But you were born 6 pounds. Not much at all. This is something you can get used to. That's why it's terrible. This living in moha, living with expectation, it's something you get used to. And you have gotten used to it. Constantly living with expectations. In the hope that there will always be some relief from expectation. When you're waiting for your bus, what are you in? State of expectation. Waiting for the train. Waiting to catch a flight. You're in a state of expectation. Waiting for the next interview. waiting for a phone call, waiting for a job offer, waiting for whatever, waiting for a call, waiting for a friend. You're always in a state of expectation, because these are very momentary. They arrive, they show up, the call comes. You see, that happens just like that. Happens in an instant. That's why I say you spend most of your time here. Sometimes people spend weeks here for 2 seconds there. And it seems like a reasonable price to pay. Does it not feel like that? You'll spend weeks here for 2 seconds of joy, relief. And you know one thing for true, for certain, because the moment you experience that relief, it's joyful, it's pleasurable only for an instant. From there on, the joy of that relief begins to fade, because there's no longer an expectation. Now, if you have applied for loans and stuff, housing loans, credit cards, bank accounts, you know, things like this, overdrafts, right? You walk up to the bank manager and say, can I have this? And they say, right, give me your paperwork. We'll take a few days. I'll come back to you with an answer. So you're waiting. While you're waiting, you're in a state of moha. And this waiting can be for how long? Sometimes weeks, sometimes months, sometimes even years. Let's say you apply for a visa to some country. Some countries, they take years to give you an answer. And then the moment they say either yes or no, if they say yes, of course you're overjoyed. I remember this because when I applied for, just soon after university, I applied for graduate jobs. I applied for about 50 of them. That's how competitive they are. Ha, no more competition. I applied for around 50 jobs. And the one I really wanted came back to me with an offer. I remember to this day, I was just over the moon when they got back to me. Because I wanted to work in a bank. And they got back to me and said, you got the offer. You have no idea. You should have. If you'd seen me then, you would not come to the sermons. I was hopping around. I had tears in my eyes, just sheer joy. Can you imagine how stressed I must have been? I was ringing around telling my friends. I was trying to get hold of my parents and they just couldn't answer the phone. You know how many missed calls they got, and they were so worried when they finally saw. When my mother rang me back, she was like, so many missed calls, is everything okay? That was the sheer amount of joy that I had. I want to tell her that I got the job. But when I found Nibbana, I let go of it like that. Because the joy of it faded. With time, the joy of it faded. That joy I only experienced the moment they gave me the offer. A week later, I wasn't the same person. Wasn't as joyful, wasn't as pleasurable. 2 weeks later, I was very casual about it. A few weeks on, I was like, yeah, it's just another job. About 2 years into it, I was like, it's about time I look for another job. Do you see that these moments of relief, we feel that they're worth the price. You ask yourself whether they are. This is the price you pay for that. This sometimes can be months, years worth of waiting. But how is it possible that we can wait for so long? What makes it possible? What makes it? How can you stomach that? How can you bear that? What makes this bearable? All this waiting. This is it. It's jati. Because you look at that. That light at the end of the tunnel. You look at the light at the end of the tunnel and you start to live that future today. That your mind can do. There's a fantastic job at doing that. It's lunacy, really. Because it's not true. Can't you mentally drive the next car you want to buy? That's what I'm talking about. Imagine the house that you want to buy. Assume you want to buy another house. You're in the market looking for a house, right? Can't you open the door, walk in your mind? Yeah, and walk up into the rooms, open the fridge, see what's in. And then walk into the washroom and see, you know, how everything is nicely laid out. Like there's a shower cubicle, there's your bathtub, right? There's a nice sink branded. And then you have the toilet, this soft closing seats and all sorts, right? So can't you imagine all that? This imagination, this ability to imagine, that makes all this bearable. Jati is what does that. That's why prison is bearable. Think about it for a second. Prison is bearable. Because they tell you when you're going to be released. What's worse than a 10-year long sentence? A 10-day long sentence. But if they don't tell you that you're going to be released in 10 days. That's worse than a 10-year long sentence. Seriously. Because even if it's 10 years away, that day that you're going to be released, what your mind can do is start to imagine that day as if it was today. That's what jati does. Jati is your sense of self. It's what creates a timeline in your mind. And as much as you know that it's going to be 10 years into the future, you can still live that day as if it was today in your mind. So in a little while you'll be doing Pindapatha, won't you? Right. Live it now in your mind, can't you? See? We've still got at least a couple of hours to go, but you can already live it in your mind. Think about the next big thing you're looking forward to. Whatever it might be, maybe a new job, a new car, a new house, a new sofa, a new husband. Where did that come from? Whatever it is you're looking forward to. Maybe it's your birthday and you're looking forward to getting some nice presents, right? Whatever it is, can't you live them in your mind now? That experience? That's what makes this waiting bearable. Makes it bearable. And don't be proud about that. Don't be proud about that. Don't be pleased about the fact that your mind can do this trick. It's nothing to boast about. The fact that your mind can live the future today. Nothing to boast about. Because what that makes you do, what that lets you do, what that allows you to do is be in a pit of suffering, yet make that bearable. Because you can imagine the day where you're going to come out of it. But all that time, where are you? In a pit of suffering, in this state of expectation. This is why the Buddha says, you know, I want to thank you today, right now, because I've never really looked at this problem through this perspective. In fact, I'm quite impressed by what I'm hearing right now. Thanks to you. I've never looked at this through this lens, and it's really making sense. Why, how come people find torture bearable? How come people find this life of suffering so bearable? Because they see that one day I can be out of this. And the worst thing about jati is, it makes you feel like all of that in the future is still available to you today. You know through knowledge that it's not there right now, but the experience of it, you can enjoy it as if it was today. That's what jati does. It's because of jati, the pain of jati becomes bearable. That's the irony of it. Jati makes the pain of jati bearable. Therefore, you never need to find a way out of it. Why would you? Because jati itself has made jati bearable. I'm trying to think of an analogy. One will come to mind in a moment. But try and understand the concept. You've got to realize, ladies and gentlemen, that this situation that you're in, this state of moha, it's not a blessing. Of course, you can look and imagine and envisage a day where you can come out of that problem, but that is always a future moment. And even when it does arrive, it will be there for a moment, for one splitting second, that's it. And after that, you are back into the regular state of affairs. The Buddha says himself that the reason that individuals go through samsara, even when there is so much suffering, is because of pleasure. Pleasure and the promise of pleasure. Like I say, you are in a state of moha because you have the promise of pleasure in your mind, that one day you can be freed from it. And because you can imagine that one day, it feels palatable, it feels tangible. Right? Because you feel that day is tangible, it makes it okay, all this suffering seems okay. If they had to amputate an arm or a leg, that is unbearable. Because you know that there's never going to be a day where you can get it back. That is these moments of dvesha. So dvesha is not something you look forward to. Whenever there's dvesha, you try to avoid that. Again, jati does that. You try to put it off. Because what does jati do again? When there's a misfortunate, when there's something painful, when there's something sufferable to come to you in the future, jati, of course, doesn't like it. But jati begins to experience the fear of it today, the pain of it today. That happens today. That happens in the present moment. If you were asked to come up on stage and give a talk to a large audience, people get the shivers. Like their palms go sweaty. They're scared, they're afraid. Especially if they don't like to perform in front of the public, performance anxiety and so on. But just imagine if that talk was something you had to do in a week's time. It's in a week's time, not today. But you still, you know, you already start feeling that fear. You already start feeling anxious. But it's in a week's time. Why are you worried today? Because what does jati do again? It brings that future, that experience of fear, that pain, it brings that today. It brings it, it makes it very real in the present moment. This is what jati does. So both this as well as this, the pleasures of raga as well as the fears and the worries of dvesha, what jati does is it makes them real in the present moment. And that's why you can be here and look forward to that. And that is also why while you are still here in the present moment, you try to avoid and push back those situations and those experiences which you know are going to bring you pain and hurt. Therefore, you can never live in the moment. Let's be honest. You can never live in the moment. We say, let's live in the moment, but you don't live in the moment. Do you really live in the moment? If you are living in the moment, why does exam fear strike you? What is exam stress? You need not worry about the exams because, you know, you're going to get your results much later. So why can't you wait until the results come? Why are you stressed on the day you write your exam? Makes no sense, right? Yeah? It's fine to be stressed. I mean, I'll give it. It's fine to be stressed on the day you get your results. But on the day you write your exam, why are you stressed? What's going on there? Because you imagine a future. The future day when you're going to fail your exams and the experience of that you have today, at this moment. Because that's what jati does. That's what jati does. Why can't you trust people? Because you're worried that at some point in the future, they will cause you harm. They will put you at a disadvantage. They will take something from you, something precious to you, something valuable to you. They will break that trust. But that's something to happen in the future. Why are you worried about it today? So where's all this, let's live in the present moment? What's all that malarkey? You say, let's live in the present moment, but you don't trust people. The two things don't agree. Someone comes up to you and says, can I borrow some money? Right? And they say, I'll pay it you back in another year. Or, you know, let's say in a week. Say in a week. So a week is in a week's time. Why don't you just give them the money now? Now. Why can't you trust them now? What, you don't trust them to take your money? You don't trust them to take your money? Then what's the problem? What's the trust problem there? What's the trust issue? Your problem is that in a week's time, they may not return the money to you. But that's in a week's time. So why are you talking about, let's live in the present moment? What present moment? Why are you talking about a present moment then? This happens to you all the time. When you cross the street, you see a vehicle coming from afar. Fear. Why? What if it runs you over? I'm not suggesting that you just have to be, you know, can be careless as you cross the street. You must always be very careful, you know. Look left, right, left. I can't remember which way you have looked now. What is it? Left, right, left. Thank you. See? I don't have to cross streets anymore. Many things I have forgotten now, how to do. I can't even remember how to cross the street anymore. That's how privileged I am. I can't remember the last time I held some money in my hand. So you give me some money today, Sri Lankan currency, I'll be like, what? Which one's that? I've forgotten what they look like, what they feel like. So you'll have to teach me. If I ever had to go back to a lay life, now that's a nightmare. If I ever had to do that, I'd have to relearn all that again. How to tie my shoelaces, how to use money, how to cross the street, how to drive a car. All of that I had to relearn because I'm privileged enough not to have to do any of that anymore. So anyhow, what was I saying? What are we talking about? How do we get there? Cross the street, yes. So when you cross the street and you look at oncoming traffic, right? You say, let's live in the moment. So what's the problem? In the moment, you're not, you know, there's no vehicle right next to you. So you're not going to die in that moment. But you look at the vehicle and if it's, you know, coming at you at top speed, then you feel scared. Why? Why scare? Why fear? Why worry? That's because you're not in the present moment. And it's not just knowledge. Knowledge doesn't bring fear. Defilements bring fear. Knowledge doesn't bring fear. So if knowledge brings fear, then just think of the Buddha. He had all the knowledge that one could ever conceive. He was the omniscient one. So then, how afraid and fearful must he be? But he wasn't. So it's not knowledge that brings fear. In fact, knowledge frees you from fear. That's what knowledge does. It frees you from fear. Defilements bring you fear. So, first of all, I want you to acknowledge that this is where you live your life. This whole thing, this life. That's life for you. You can't deny that fact. You're always in moha, raga, or dvesha. Try it out in the course of the next week, or at least one day, or at least until the end of today, right? Because you'll probably forget. But at least until the end of today, catch yourself and ask yourself, where am I? Am I in moha, raga, or dvesha? And then you realize that every moment of your waking life, you spend in one of these three states. You're either in moha, or you're in raga, or you're in dvesha. And see how proud you feel of yourself then. And then you tell me, finally, where you think happiness in life is. After you've looked at this and you've done the experiment, right, the lab of life, okay, once you've gone through that, you come back and tell me next week where you expect to be happy in your life. Which part of life is going to be the happy part? There is no happy part. I'll tell you now. There's no happy part. It's only the moha part, raga part, or the dvesha part. That's the one of the three states you're always in. Why do you expect to be happy in your life? Why do you all look so miserable right now? I'm only stating a fact, that's all. I'm not trying to make your life miserable. It already is. Right, so don't look at me like I'm the one who's responsible for all your miseries. I'm not the one who's making your life miserable. You are. My comment is this. You're always in one of these three states, and yet you expect to live a happy life. It makes no sense, ladies and gentlemen. Argue your case then. Come on. Put your case forward. Prove me wrong. And tell me, no, Swami Nansa, there are times when I'm really, really, really happy. Which one is that? What is the experience when you're really, really, really happy? There can only be one. When you're mindful of the Dhamma, that's all. Because here's what happens when you're mindful of the Dhamma. You go from moha to wisdom. And then you live in the presence. You become pachupanna. You live in the presence. The moment you live in the presence, what happens? Expectations? Out. No expectations. Because there's nothing to expect in the presence. In the present, there's nothing to expect. You live in the present. That's all. You live. That's it. Live. Live the present. No future. No past to worry about. No future to look forward to. Once again, I'm not talking about planning things and so on, because I plan all the time. It's part of my job. I always plan. But planning is not the same as suffering because of your plans, or having fear because of your plans, worrying about your plans. That has nothing to do with that. Those are because of defilements. You can have zero jati, zero defilements, and still plan. Because to plan, you just need knowledge. You need knowledge about how things work out. You need knowledge about the conventional sense of time. That's what you need. Conventional sense of time. You need some knowledge about that. That there's such a thing called seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years. Right? You need to have knowledge about that. And you need to know that one round along the clock is 12 hours. You just need to know that. That's it. That's knowledge. With knowledge, you can plan things. You can plan your company. You can plan your future. You can plan tomorrow. But the problem is, you don't just plan your future, plan your tomorrow. Because of jati, you start expecting that experience of tomorrow. You try and expect these and you try and avoid these. In your mind, you're always doing that. So in other words, you expect these outcomes and you expect these not to come. That's what happens. They're both expectations. These to come and these not to come. Don't you? You expect them to come and then not to come. They're both expectations. And that's the expectation you're always in. If you keep pets at home, how long do you want them to live? For a few weeks? For a few days? For a few years? Typically for a lifetime. If they could live forever, wouldn't you like it? Of course, you'd like it if they could live forever. But you know, when you buy a dog, or you bring a dog home, typically 10 years, 12 years, something like that. Right? But if you could get them to live forever, if you could make a wish, and that wish was granted, right? And you could make your pets live forever, wouldn't you? I mean, why wouldn't you? Of course you would. Because they're your pets. You would like them to live forever. You love them. So that is an expectation you have. You want them to live for as long as possible. In fact, you don't like the fact that there is as possible in that sentence. Because you know that there's somewhere along that line where you have to say, no, they're going to die. That part you don't like, but you've made your mind up about it because that's the way it is. So if that is true about your pets, then what more can be said about your family and members of your family? The same. How long do you want your mother to live? What sort of a question is that, eh? How long would you want your mother to live? What's the answer? Forever, of course. Provided, of course, that she was not going to fall ill. Yeah? And she would not become incapacitated. Right? You'd want her to be able to live for forever. Of course, everyone would want that. But you've kind of made your mind up that because you know that people typically, you know, their lives come to an end at 120. So you've kind of made your mind up about that. But that's not something you like. It's something you've had to settle for. You don't like that. That's why you always live in hope. Every time you think of your mother, if your mother is still alive, you're always hoping that she will live another day, another day, another day, another day. The same goes for your children, the same goes for your spouses, the same goes for your pets. It goes for anything and everything that you have and set hopes for, hopes on. So the long and short of this is, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, please accept, not because I say so, but because you really understand that you're always in one of these three states. And none of these states is something to be happy about. Because you're in raga, which is simply a momentary relief from the vexation of expectation. That's all. The moment you are released from that state of vexation, you're back into another state of expectation. And when you are in dvesha, of course you're not happy about that. That's the last thing you want. You hate that. Therefore, you try and, you know, change your mind, shift your attention to something else. That's what you like to do. You want to start thinking about something. You don't like to think about these things even, dvesha. You try and avoid them. But you can't escape this. Not until you get the Dhamma. That is the great escape. the escape from raga, dvesha and moha. That is why the Buddha says, when asked, Venerable Sir, how do we know that the Dhamma that we hear is the Dhamma that is taught by you, uttered once by the great master, the Buddha? He says, if when you listen to the teaching, you realize that you are being freed from raga, dvesha and moha, then you must come to know that that was a teaching of the Tathagata. Because no other teaching frees you from this cycle of raga, dvesha and moha. So that is the litmus test of whether a teaching is a teaching of the Tathagata. So now I'm going to talk to you about expectation. But I gave you this preamble to help you understand why it is I'm going to talk to you about expectations. So you know the relevance of what I'm going to be talking to you about next. Do you wish to be freed from this? Or do you wish to be freed from this? Then there's a door up there. If you wish to be freed from this, in other words, if you wish to be freed from expectation, unfulfilled expectations as well as fulfilled expectations. Don't fall in love with this, but it's easy to fall in love with it if you don't open your eyes and look at really what's going on. This is, like I said, when you scratch your rash, that feeling of pleasure, you can't be happy about that. You can't fall in love with that. Come on. It's a rash. Agreed? Make sense? Yeah. So then if you want to be freed, you must want to be freed from the whole package of all raga, dvesha and moha. Typically what people want to be freed from is just the dvesha part. They say, no, can I be freed from this one? But can I have this, please? That's just nonsense. How can that be? Because all of these are causal. This is just cause and effect. No one's in control here. There's no doer here. When causes align, that is the result that manifests. So sometimes it manifests these situations, other times it manifests these situations, yet other times it manifests these situations, and they're not in our control. But you're constantly in this expectation. Therefore, true freedom, ladies and gentlemen, then come from freedom from all this whole package. That is the great escape. So to escape this prison, you need to understand what an expectation is and how expectations arise, how expectations form in your mind. Why is that? What are these two things? Fulfilled expectations and unfulfilled expectations. So don't expectations exist in all of this? Yeah. There's a slither of expectation in everywhere, in all of this. It's sprinkled everywhere. Expectation is all over the place. Okay? So that's where we're going to talk. And what are we going to talk about next? How do we seize expectation? But first, you need to understand why expectation is a problem. All on board? Excellent. Then let's talk about expectation. So what are you expecting me to talk about now? Gotcha! See? I have you right where I want you. I got you here now. See, unbeknown to you, you fall into these traps. See how I got you nicely into this trap? Now you're expecting me to talk to you how to free yourself from expectation. Let's talk about something else then, shall we? That's not nice. Let's talk about expectation then, shall we? See? Do you see this, the trap that you're in? Okay. Right. So this is something I talked about yesterday. Put your hand up if you were in yesterday's sermon. Okay, only a handful. Good. So most of you, this is new. So refresher for second timers and knowledge for the first. What do I have in my hand? An envelope. Why do you think it's an envelope? How do you know that it's an envelope? Yeah, it's got a stamp up here. There's an address, right? If you look on the other side, it resembles an envelope, right? And you should be able to open it and you should be able to envelope a letter. That's why we call this an envelope. So, aren't there certain characteristics that you identify about this object that I have in my hand that qualifies this to be called an envelope? Yes? What are those characteristics? Name a few. Stamp. So that it can actually get somewhere. That's the mileage. This is the address. So without that, this would be of no use. Right? Then there's a flap at the back, which you can open, put in the contents, right? And then seal it so that its contents can be kept safe, secured. Yeah? That is what qualifies us to be called an envelope. So it's a bunch of characteristics that you identify and recognize here. Do you agree with me on that? All of you. Put your hand up if that didn't make sense. So when you say that this is an envelope, what you're referring to, you're simply giving a name to a whole bunch of characteristics. Yes? Yeah. So this is a what? Envelope. A what? What did you say it was? Ah, it's now a sheet of paper, is it? Why have you changed your mind all of a sudden? Exactly. Well done. What's changed? Characteristics have changed. Where did the envelope go? Has anyone seen it? Where did the envelope go? Did you see anyone walk up to the stage and take it away? No. So what was the envelope then? Just a collection of characteristics. Right now you say that this is a sheet of paper and it helps you to think of this as a notepaper because I place a pen close to it. That was a prop to help you come to that conclusion. Whereas, you know, if I'd say, did that. Not right. Something's not right. But the moment I do that, this becomes a sheet of paper. And what might you do now? Write on it. You could write a letter on it. What makes you think now that this is a sheet of paper on which you can write a note? Characteristics, indeed. Because it's a clean sheet of paper. It's a clear sheet of paper, isn't it? So what happened then? What was that shift from envelope to sheet of paper? What happened? Characteristics changed, yes. It's the arrangement that changed, isn't it? It was an arrangement that changed. So the sheet of paper, this thing that I have in my hand, its arrangement manifested characteristics. Initially, that of an envelope. Now, a blank sheet of paper. So what is this? What is this? A what? No, wait, you said it was an envelope first. So it's an envelope? No? A sheet of paper. Then? A paper. You're so fickle, aren't you? Just keep changing your minds just like that. Why did you change your mind now again? And call it a rocket. What happened? Characteristics. See, no longer can you observe the characteristics of an envelope. No longer can you observe the characteristics of a sheet of paper, a note paper. Now you observe the characteristics of a paper rocket, a paper plane. What changed? Arrangement, indeed. The arrangement changed. It's the same stuff, isn't it? Just a change of structure. Arrangement. Do you see how when the same thing only changes arrangement, different characteristics manifest? I really want you to get that idea into your mind. It's just the same thing. Only a change in the way that it's arranged. And then you get different characteristics. And then we use it for very different things. Initially we put a letter into it, but now you wouldn't do that with this. You wouldn't write a note on this and send to someone. This is to play. This is... If only I didn't come in a robe, I'd do that right now, but it's not fitting for a monk, so I wouldn't do that. I could even make a paper boat out of this. In Japan, they call it origami. Using the same bit of material, you fold it in different ways, meaning, in other words, change its arrangement and manifest various characteristics. See, when I'm done with this, I could just take the whole thing, crumple it like this, and use it as a torch. If I lit one end of this, what would it be? A torch. So, was it not an envelope? Where's the envelope now? See, that's why they say nothing comes or goes. Nothing comes or goes. They all manifest. Get that idea into your heads. Manifest. Manifestation is this. Nothing comes or goes. The envelope never came and it never went, because there wasn't such a thing called an envelope. Remember last week we talked about things? You remember? So what's this whole conversation anchored around? Don't forget that. That's why we are talking about this. Yeah? So we must tie all this back to that in a moment. Okay? Last week we talked about things. And what two types of things did we talk about? Well done. There were the living things and the non-living things. When I first held the envelope in my hand, your mind kept telling you that that was a thing. that it was a living, sorry, it was a non-living thing and it was an envelope thing. That thing was an envelope. That's what your mind said. That's what your mind murmured that is what you felt. That it was a thing, it was an envelope. And then when I made the rocket out of this, or the piece of sheet of paper, a note paper, then that was a thing. And then we made the paper plane, then that was the thing. But ultimately they were all things. So much so that you say one thing became another thing. This entification is the result of ignorance. How we entify things in our minds, we tend to think of objects as fixed objects, fixed entities. But you have seen this happen right before your eyes, ladies and gentlemen, how nothing is fixed. The envelope is not a fixed object. It's merely the arrangement of some material. This is energy. Why do I call this energy? Isn't this paper? Why do I call this energy? What is this made of? If you keep going down to its building blocks? Absolutely. You go down to protons, electrons, neutrons, atoms and so on. And then, one fine day, a scientist came along and said that all matter can also be referred to as energy. Who was that scientist? Einstein. So thanks to Einstein, the science community today believes that energy and mass are interchangeable. So much so that mass is considered to be a quantity of energy in a system. So this is a system. Seems really bizarre to think of this as a system, it's a piece of paper. But in scientific terms, in scientific terminology, this is a system. That's why it has a weight. You can put it on a scale and it will give you the amount of mass here. But actually this is just energy. This is energy at rest. Do you see that? This is energy at rest. So when energy is at rest, we start talking about mass. What is the weight of light? How much does light weigh? How much does heat weigh? Heat. Why can't you talk? Give me a figure. This is not at rest. Yeah. It's not at rest. But this energy is at rest. Therefore we call it mass. Skanda. Call it mass. So the amount of energy within a system, or you can think of it as amount of energy at rest, is considered mass. But let's not be fooled to think that mass is one and energy is another. This is energy, ladies and gentlemen, as much as this is. It's all energy. So there's energy in motion and there's energy at rest. This is energy at rest. So if you were to say that this is, let's say, 20 grams. There's 20 grams of what? Energy. That's what there is. 20 grams of energy. Show me 80 kilograms of energy. 80 plus kilograms of energy. Yeah, there you go. Okay, you got the idea. Right, it's making sense now. Right? So you know that all there is energy then. So if all there is energy, why do we still think about the world as through this lens of things? If all there is energy. And the funny thing is, energy is always in a state of dynamic equilibrium. Meaning, the best example I can give you is you. Day in, day out, you're expending energy. Your bodies are heating up. That's why you say it's sometimes too warm. And then you tick, tick, tick that. Because you're giving out heat. Your bodies are generating heat. So when you generate heat, what's that? Energy. What are you doing with that energy? Giving it out, right? But how do you recover that energy? By eating food. Yeah, so aren't you in a constant state of dynamic equilibrium? Yes. You're always giving off energy and you're taking in energy. Therefore, you are just a flux of energy. You are not static energy. You are a constantly dynamic collection of energy. What happens when you stop taking energy? What happens when you stop taking energy? You die. What does that mean? What does it mean to die? Yeah, so when that dynamic equilibrium ceases, meaning there's only the dissipation of energy, but no intake, that's when we can say that someone's dead. Because what happens when the body is borrowed? Sorry, borrowed? Buried, yes, not borrowed. When the body is buried, what happens then? That is energy, but now being dissipated. It's released into the environment. But no more energy is put back in. You know, in very crude terms, but I think you get the gist of this. There's still a flux of energy in and out, but I don't want to confuse you with that. But in very simple terms, once you stop eating, all that happens is you keep expending. So you can keep, can remain alive for as long as there's enough stored energy to keep your systems up and running. But constantly there's energy dissipated. When you pass away stools, what is that? That's energy. Some other creature might consume that. Why? Because that's energy. When you shed your skin, what is that? Energy. So where is that energy produced? Well, it's not produced, it's consumed, it's taken in. Because you don't produce energy. You consume energy. And then you spend energy. So when your hair falls, what is that? That's energy. So, are you static? What are you? Dynamic. Dynamic energy. You're in a state of dynamic equilibrium. So at any given time, there's about approximately 75 to 80 kilos of what? Energy. Dynamically equilibrium energy. Now you see, you're learning to look at yourselves through a very different lens now. And you thought that you were one object, you were one thing, but really now you're beginning to learn that actually I'm not static at all. This is just constantly changing. This is just a dynamic flux of energy. So then why do we think of ourselves as things then? Because this word thing gives us this impression that it's somehow fixed, it's static, it's done. That's why we say that the world is full of living things and non-living things. But the truth is not that. The truth is that the world is full of flows of energy. That's all there is. As I hold this piece of paper in my hand, there's energy flowing from the hand to the paper, and there's energy flowing from the paper to the hand. This is dynamic. You can't see it. But that's what's going on. So I'm sharing electrons with this piece of paper. And the paper is sharing electrons with my hand. So when I do that, a part of me is now on this piece of paper. And a part of the paper is now on me. So if the paper is energy, and I'm also energy, what's happened? Energy has just, it's just an exchange of energy, that's all. But why do we feel that this is me and this is this? Ah, that's right. This separation that happens in our minds alone. When we think and feel that these are distinct objects and they are entities and they are by themselves and we are by ourselves. Distinct and discrete objects, not constant flows and interchanges of energy. That way of thinking is flawed, ladies and gentlemen. But that is how we have trained ourselves to think. Our ignorant minds think of the world in that way. Does that part make sense to all of you? What we've just talked about? Please put your hand up if that didn't make a lot of sense. Okay. So very quickly again. This is just energy. And energy is constantly in the state of dynamic equilibrium. What does that mean? What is, sounds like a really profound word, but what does it actually mean? Exchange. It just means energy is exchanged all the time. But there's a system here, and that system is able to capture this amount of energy. That's why this doesn't disperse all of a sudden. That's why this, you know, not all of the energy just flows out and this just becomes nothing. There's a system here that keeps this amount of energy concentrated in this place, in this location. And there's a system here that keeps this amount of energy concentrated in this place. That's why I don't grow extra digits. That's why my hand is just doesn't keep growing and it stops at this size. There's a system there that puts decides all that. No doer, but that's cause and effect again. So we call it DNA when it comes to these bodies. But there's a system here that does that. I can get more scientific, but it's not necessary because I just want to get this point across to you. There are things called Higgs fields and so on, but we don't need to go that far. I just need to get the point across to you. Okay? Clear so far? Right. Now, we have to come back here though. Otherwise, this is just science. Knowledge for the sake of it, we can't plug it back here because you said that is what you want to escape from. Raga, dvesha and moha. So where's the moha in all this is the next question for us to figure out. What was this at the beginning? An envelope. You could be forgiven, couldn't you, for thinking, when I unfolded the envelope. Yeah, you saw me unfold the envelope. One could be forgiven, couldn't they, for thinking that I have somehow, I don't know, killed is the wrong word, destroyed? What did I do to the envelope? Rearrange is the right word though, that's the thing. I had somehow undone the envelope. Changed. The idea I want to get across to you is the fact that I have somehow destroyed the envelope. That this is a broken envelope. Those words just I don't know, they're not perfect, but as long as you get the idea. To think of this just as a broken envelope. But it's not that. There was no envelope to begin with, but there was no envelope to destroy. I don't know, destroy doesn't sound too dramatic for something like this. But there was no envelope in my hand to destroy. Disfigure? Well, you get the idea, right? You know what I'm talking about. But that's how our minds like to interpret this. That I've done something to the envelope and now it's like this. And then when I made the paper rocket, I destroyed the sheet of paper, the note paper. I disfigured it. I broke it. But that's not what happened. Nothing was ever done to then break. Things are not done and finished to be broken because they are constantly in a state of dynamic equilibrium. Energy is constantly flowing here and there Therefore, it's not done at all. It's never done. Yes, it's always... I'm cautious about using the word changing for one reason. That is because when we talk about change, we still think that there's one thing that changed into something else. Because even that is not quite right. Nothing was there to change into something else. So you have a flower and it withers. Right? We say, look at that flower that has now withered. We tend to think, do you remember we did this with the candle? Right? I lit a candle for you and then I blew it out. And then I asked you, which candle did I blow out? And then you said, the one that was lit. Do you remember that conversation we had? So you told me, you accused me of blowing out the once lit candle. Whereas I was trying to argue my case and said, no, I never blew out a lit candle. But our minds tend to think of it like that, that one thing changes to another. That's because we tend to think about things as things that exist in space-time. We think that things exist in time, therefore things change over time. And that's what you think has happened with this as well. I know logically now your brains have kind of gone like mash, because you know that logically that makes no sense, but intuition tells you, well, yeah, it's changed. So now there's this disagreement, there's a disparity between what your brain knows but what your mind says. So we'll cross that bridge in just a moment. But as you look at this, your mind screaming out to you saying, look at what Swami Nivasa did to that lovely envelope. Now it's ruined it. Especially when I did this. Right, it was a nice paper plane earlier. See, Swami Nivasa has done what to it? He has ruined it. He's ruined it. Or even changed it. See, when I hold this in my hand, your mind tells you that there was a rocket here once before. You can still see that rocket in your mind. Although your eyes don't confirm that, your mind still sees the rocket here. And it tells you that the rocket was the previous version of this. That's because you still think in terms of time. This temporal realities, ladies and gentlemen, are fantasies. These are psychological fantasies. The Buddha's teaching does not agree with that way of thinking. The Buddha says that there is no such thing called time. Things don't exist in the dimension of time. Things don't travel across the dimension of time. There was no past of a present and a future of the present. But our minds tend to tie all these things up together and create a picture of how things exist and their past and their futures. This is flawed thinking. Because all there is cause and effect. And effects manifest when there are causes, when the causes are present. So right now, this is what manifests. Why? Because these are the causes. These are the causes that manifest this effect. Previously you saw a paper plane. Why? Because those were the causes that manifested at that time. What's wrong is to think that this was a paper plane earlier. And what's wrong is to think that the paper plane became this. That is what is wrong. Why is it wrong? Because what happens then is you put these two states onto a timeline. And the moment you do that, you discard this philosophy, this doctrine of akalika, timelessness. And they become time-bound, temporal. Now, how much of that made sense to you? If it didn't, please put your hand up. I'll go over it again. Okay, right. There are a few people. Right, let's go through that again. This is just energy. When energy changes arrangement, we observe different characteristics or various characteristics. So as we change the arrangement of energy, you witness that the characteristics that were once present were no longer present the moment you change those, the energy compositions. I could have done the same by maybe cutting out part of this paper, because that would also be a change in energy, but that would be almost a permanent change in energy. I couldn't potentially put that back. But instead of doing that, what I did is I simply changed its arrangement, not changed the quantity of energy, but only the arrangement of energy. Understand the difference between the two? Yeah? I kept the quantity of energy constant, but I changed the arrangement of energy. But merely the change of arrangement is enough to manifest different characteristics. I need not change its quantities. Make sense? Does that make sense? Good. So, to think then that the envelope became the plane or the rocket. To think that the envelope became the plane, here's what must happen in your mind. Your mind must accept first that the envelope is a thing. And your mind must also accept that the plane is a thing. Granted, they are non-living things. And then to think that the plane now has become, or the envelope has now become the plane. In fact, you might say that this is a broken envelope, isn't it? Isn't it? What is a plane? It's a broken envelope. So what was the envelope then? It's a broken plane. But do you understand what I mean by broken here in this context? It's disfigured, it's distorted, it's ruined, right? Destructed, right? It's just no longer that structure. Now, I can accept it when you said, when we had the paper, the note paper, or notepad or whatever, right? The notepad, fair enough, broken envelope. Because you saw me unfold it. But then I refolded it. But only that time it was into the shape of a plane. So then the envelope is a broken notepaper, the notepaper is a broken plane, the plane is a broken notepaper, and the notepaper is a broken envelope. Is that what's going on? Things break like that. No. All we witnessed, really, all your eyes saw was a change of characteristics. One was an envelope because it had the characteristics of what we refer to as an envelope. The notepaper was merely a bunch of characteristics, and the plane was merely a bunch of characteristics. These characteristics manifested because there was a change in the arrangement of energy. What I need you to do, ladies and gentlemen, not because I say so, but because of, through your understanding, come to sense about the fact that it's not the envelope that became the paper. Because if you say that the envelope became the paper, now what you're saying is the envelope has a future, and in that future, it stops being an envelope and it starts being a plane. But then you will say that the plane was the envelope and it's now a broken envelope. Because the envelope broke and instead we made the plane. But that's not how things work. But that is what your minds will tell you, because that is how Japi works. Buddha's teaching is very different to that. Let me use a slightly different example. We'll come back to this one. Okay. What do you call this? For math, we used to do this. What? No. I mean, tally. Pragnan Lakuno?
Tallies? Tallies?
That's okay. So we take a tally, right? So you go 1, 2, 3. As you count things, you do this. Tallies?
Tallies.
So this is, what number is this? 3. When I add another one, did 3 become 4? I really want you to think about this. Did 3 become 4? Did 3 become 4? No, 3 never became 4. This is 4. That's it. It was 3 earlier because there were only enough causes to manifest 3. When you bring in another cause, it's not that now 3 has become 4. There's now enough causes for 4 to manifest. But if you said that it was 3 that became 4, you'll say, now see, 3 has changed to become 4. That's wrong. Things don't change. Because if you think that 3 became 4, then here's what happened. At 1 second, it was 3. At 2 seconds, it was 4. So you can say at 0 seconds, there was none. At 1 second, it was 3. And at 2 seconds, it was 4. So what you're saying is, over time, 3 became 4. See, now you put this on a time dimension. This becomes kalika. Time bound. The Buddha says, no, that's not how things work. Things are not time bound. Things are driven by cause and effect. When there are enough causes for 3 to manifest, that is what manifests. When there are sufficient causes for 4 to manifest, that is what manifests. It's not that 3 became 4. I could do the same this way. So what is that? 3. What is that? 34. So 3 became 34? How can 3 become 34? Do you understand the principle I'm trying to get across to you? It is not that 3 became 34. I mean, look at it. 3 was in the ones place, wasn't it? Now it's in the tens place. So how did 3 become 34 then? So where's the 3 that became 34 now? If 3 became 34, where's that 3 that became 34? Well, you will fail at that question because you can't show me a 3. Because if you say that is 3, that's not 3, that's 30. But our minds always tell us that things change. Because what happened to your grandmother? 10 years ago, she was what? She was young. 15 years ago, 20 years ago, she was very young. And then what happened? She changed. Now she's old. Because the way we use language always communicates these wrong ideas to us. Because your parents tell you, "Puta, Achyam is old now, no." So Achyam is old? No. Meaning, back then, she was young. We indoctrinate our people, our children, with this ignorance all the time. If the Buddha was there when you said that, he would give you a kick. He would say, "When did I ever say that that was true?" Because we always speak in terms of time. These temporal realities are only hallucinations of the mind. But what truly happens, ladies and gentlemen, is characteristics manifest because of causes. That is what I wanted to show you with this piece of paper. What I brought in my hand was an envelope. That envelope never changed to a plane. That's not what happened. All I did was change the arrangement. Actually, it's not even change the arrangement. That's the thing. Because we always think about it in terms of time, you think, okay, Swami Nuhansi changed the arrangement. So there was one arrangement, that arrangement got changed. And then naturally, of course, you would say the envelope became the plane. No, that's not what happened. There was no changing that happened. But it's very difficult for us to see it that way. There was no changing that happened. All that happened was momentary causes and effects. So a whole series of causes and effects later, you see a plane. It's not that the envelope became the plane. And the past of the plane is not the envelope. Now how do we tie it back to moha? When you think of this as an envelope, right? I don't know whether you remember. I hope you do. Do you recall that once we talked about this, when you say that something's something, you also imply that it's what? Nothing else. So when you say that it is an envelope, this is what you speak out loud. What are you saying within braces? And it's nothing else. So if something's an envelope, don't you have expectations of an envelope? Don't you expect certain things from an envelope? Like what? Exactly. It should be able to contain something that you put into it. That's an expectation that you have of an envelope. See, something as simple and so innocent like an envelope, and you still set expectations. What else do you expect of an envelope? Why do you remember what I did with that and say open the flap and go? You should be able to seal it, right? So it has to have some gum. Yeah? Then there are some envelopes that don't come with that. And some do. Like, which ones do you like better? The ones that do, right? Yeah. Isn't that an expectation that you have? So if it's an envelope, it should come with a bit of gum at the back. So it's easy to seal it. And then, when you have a stamp, what must you be able to do? Stick it. What if you kept putting the stamp on but it didn't stick? On that envelope, on that particular envelope, if it didn't stick, would you be happy with the envelope or would you be disappointed? You'd be disappointed. And you must also be able to write the address on it, right? So you get your standard pen, you try and write on it, but it doesn't write. Would you be okay with that or would you be disappointed? You'd be disappointed. So the fact that you're constantly disappointed with these things mean you have a whole bunch of what? Expectations. On what? The envelope. Therefore, if something's an envelope, don't you have expectations? That's a very simple question. If something's an envelope, don't you have expectations of it? What expectations? Envelope expectations. Yes, you have all of the expectations you would typically place for an envelope on the envelope. Don't we go back now to moha, raga and dvesha? Aren't we in that realms now? So then the moment you think of this as an envelope, what happens? That is an expectation placed. The moment this becomes an envelope in your mind, ladies and gentlemen, you are now in the realms of expectation. That is moha. So the moment you're in moha, now it's a two-pronged path. You can either go left and go to raga or go right and go dvesha. No escape. See, what was the sin? To expect this to be an envelope. Hardly a sin, isn't it? Well, that's hardly a sin. But see, the very moment you take this for granted, you take this as an object, you fixate this, or you fix this, you entify this as an envelope, The moment you do that, you are now into the world of moha. If that is true about this, what can you tell me about this?
Same.
Then what can you tell me about this? Then what can you tell me about this? Then what can you tell me about this? Then what can you tell me about everything? Same. So you're telling me then, are you, that when you call this an eraser, and you really think of this as an eraser, eraser? Duster. When you think of this as a duster, you would even say that, see? In case you don't. In case you think of this as merely a collection of energy, right, just to avoid that from happening, what do? They write it here. They say it's a dust, right? The moment you take this as a duster, what are you now? In expectation. You are now in a state of moha. That's why you pick this up and you wipe the board and you expect it to be able to wipe. If it can, now you go from moha to raga. What if it doesn't? Dvesha. And then the fact that this is a duster then becomes what? That's moha. Means expectation. So, you tell me then now, if this is true about the few artifacts and objects we've talked about on this desk, what is life? What do you do all day, every day? Interact with objects, right? Things, that's what you interact with, things. You take them for granted as things. Your house for you is a house, it's a thing. Your car is a thing. Your cat is a thing. This chair is a thing. Because when you sit on it, you expect it to bear your weight. That's an expectation. When you take a plate and you put your food on it, there are two expectations. One is the plate, the other is the food. When you have a papadam, no expectations? Of course you do. It must smell of it, it must taste of it, it must look it, it must sound like it. It must feel like it. All of these are expectations. So the moment something becomes a papadam, what happens to you? You become a papadam. See, you are in moha. That's why I said, you spend your whole life in moha, raga and dvesha. For the simple error in your thinking, that is, there are things in this world. But science tells you, this is what a scientist says. The scientist says, no, there are no things in this world. They are merely aggregations of energy that are in a constant state of equilibrium or dynamic equilibrium. Energy flows in, energy flows out. It's a flux of energy. That's what the scientist says. But the scientist himself has a problem. He has a problem himself. That is, although he finds this out at in the laboratory, when he looks at an object, he still sees an object. He perceives an object, just like you and I. He perceives the object as well. So he can give a lecture on this and say, this is just equilibrium, dynamic equilibrium, he will say. E equals mc squared, and he'll tell you how much energy there is in all this. And then he will hold a pen in his hand and go, that's a pen. And when he doesn't write, he goes, he does that. The scientist does that. He gets frustrated. He gets disappointed. How so? This is the thing. The reason for this is, ladies and gentlemen, although in the laboratory he discovers that this is merely dynamic equilibrium, what he doesn't know is, in his mind, there's another story that's going on. And he doesn't know what's going on in his own mind. He's blind to that. Let's quickly see what he's blind to. That'll be the last piece of our story. Right, let's see what he's blind to. Let's see what who's blind to? The scientist is blind to. Okay? You can be forgiven for thinking that this is a duster, but a scientist should not really be. Why? Because he knows the equations. He knows the formulae. He's done the experiments. He's got the electron microscope to figure out that there's no dust here, but merely protons, electrons, neutrons, and stuff. And he's done the math and worked out that all mass can also be converted to energy. Therefore, this is merely energy. But he knows that. So he can't be forgiven for thinking that this is an object, this is a thing. You and I, we're just average jokes, right? For us, it's okay. But not the scientist. But then why does the scientist make the same error in judgment as you do? And here's the reason for that. All there is in this world then. Oh, I shouldn't have moved this. Is it still okay on the camera? Okay. All there is in this world, we know, is now energy. Yeah? And collections of energy. Just what you saw me do with this piece of paper. Think of this as energy. Think of this as energy. What you saw me do was manipulate energy. I manipulated energy to manifest what? What? Characteristics, indeed. Different characteristics, not different things. Different characteristics. That's what I did. I really, really, really want you to take that away from today's talk. I manipulated energy to manifest different characteristics, not things. Things only happen with moha. So all there is energy, collections of energy, arrangements of energy. There are energy arrangements, arrangements of energy. Now, let's take an object. Take a flower. So if this is an arrangement of energy, what is this? Right? Pretty clear on that? Okay. So anything is the same. Yeah? Let's put an eye in front of it. Your eye in front of it. What is this now again? It's an arrangement of energy. That's what it is. We call this skanda. Skanda is a collection. That's what a skanda is. You heard of pancha skanda? These are five collections. Rupa skanda, Vedana skanda, Sanya skanda, Sankara skanda, Vijnana skanda. These are all skanda. Skanda means energy. Sorry, not energy. Collections. That's what skanda means. That's why kanda is called kanda. Kanda. Like mountains. They're called kanda, right? Why are they called kanda? Because it's a collection of sand, dust, rock, soil, and all that stuff. It's a collection of stuff. So this is also a kanda or a skanda. It's a collection of energy. So this eye has been placed there to perceive what? A collection of energy. That's what the eye is supposed to perceive. And frankly, that is what it does actually. That is what it does. Once you place the eye or the object in front of the eye, here's what happens. We've talked about this in the past. You have rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, and vijnana. And when we can say a chitta is born, you still see that? Just about. This is a chitta. You've seen me draw this on the board many, many times, too many times for you to forget. Right? There's a chitta is born. This chitta, we have talked about this countless times, is the process of perception. This is the process of perception. This is how form or rupa is perceived. They call this form, rupa. Form. Formations. What does that word mean to you? Formation. So, you know, in the army they say, all stand in formation. Arrangement, exactly. Now, do you see, I want you to take that idea from this word formation. It's an arrangement. Isn't that what this is now? That's what we've been talking about for the last half an hour. Formations are merely arrangements of what? Energy. That's why it's called form. That's why it's called a formation. So once a formation has been presented to the eye, what can happen next is the perception of that formation. The Vedana of that formation. Vedana is to come to awareness. Sanya is to give it an identification of what? The formation, ladies and gentlemen, the formation. Sankara is to construct this chitta to finally perceive it. Excuse me. And then finally we have vijnana, which is the final perception stage. So now, when it has come to this stage, we can finally say that perception of what has happened, perception of an arrangement has happened. Because what is this after all? An arrangement. An arrangement of what? Energy. Is that clear to everyone? Make sense? Anyone that didn't add? Okay, once more. Rupa is form. Form again is aggregation of energy. Now we've already crossed this bridge where we have come to an agreement that all objects around us is merely collections and arrangement, aggregations of energy, right? So then form is that. So you might wonder, why am I writing R when I say form? That's because the Pali term for that is rupa. That's why I've written R instead of F. So once the rupa has been presented to the eye, the mind's job, you as a mind, the mind's job is now to perceive this formation. Well, it's a formation, so don't perceive it as anything else. Perceive it as a formation, or rather an arrangement of energy. Don't perceive it as anything else. And frankly, like I said, that is what the mind does. It doesn't perceive it as anything else. It only perceives it as an arrangement of energy. And that's exactly what's going on here. Vedana. Vedana is to come to awareness. This is the notification. That's what happens there in the mind. An arrangement of energy has just been presented. That's the alert. The mind goes, comes to awareness. Then comes sanya. Sanya is where we give it some identification. Identification for what? This arrangement of energy, nothing more. This arrangement, this formation. Then you have sankhara. Sankhara is the process that happens within the mind to bring all this together, because it has to bring rupa, vedana and sanya together to finally give it the final perception. So when I say perception, that's kind of like the final idea, the final picture of what the whole thing is. You might, if you want, you can even write it like this. Imagine this is a math problem and this is a summation. Right, so instead of the plus sign, I put sankhara. So that is the function of sankhara, this addition. So the rupa, vedana, sanya, what sankhara does is it adds all of them up together and finally gives out the final product, vijnana. Because vijnana would be nothing if not the sum total of rupa, vedana and sanya. Make sense? Right, so that's what sankhara does. Right, so then we have the chitta. So the chitta then, this is just a visual representation of this. Once I've done this, I don't even need to draw this. I don't need to confuse you. So this is what happens. This is a chitta. This is what's happening in you right now, all the time. Chittas. They arise and pass away. Doing what? Or having done what? Perceived. Perceived what? Things? No, then arrangements. Arrangements of what? Energy. Well done. That's what they do. They perceive arrangements of energy. Well, at least that's what they're supposed to do. But then there's you. This is the Arahant. And then there's you. Where does it all go wrong for us is the last piece of this puzzle. That's where we have the defiling process. This is called the perception process. Then there's the defiling process. An Arahant is an individual or a chitta that is not influenced, that is not contaminated by the defiling process. But it was once. It was once. It's like rust on an iron. It was once rusty. But once you remove the rust, once you de-rust it, then you have the good iron, right? The same is going on with you right now. You are all Arahants. Wait, don't get carried away. You're all Arahants, but what? But for the defiling process. Each and every one of you is this by default. This is happening right now within you, ladies and gentlemen. When you open your eye and you look at an aggregation of energy, a collection of energy, that is what you see. A collection of energy. That is what you truly see with your eye. Not with your eye, but with your mind. But the problem is, it doesn't stop there. This process gets hijacked by the defiling process. Because the defiling process runs over this, then you perceive something entirely different. So let's just go over what that defiling process is so that you can all finally make sense of why is it that when I look at an arrangement of energy, I don't see an arrangement of energy, yet I perceive that there's a flower, there's a thing, there's an object, there's a plane, there's an envelope. That's the last piece. Ready for it? All right, let's talk about that then finally. Right, so this is what it's supposed to be. This is what's supposed to happen. Right? And it is what happens in the Arahant. It is also what happens in you, but it doesn't stop there because there's another layer that gets added on top. What's that layer? It all starts with ignorance. All starts with ignorance. I mean, ignorance is a culprit, after all. That is where everything goes wrong. When asked, the Buddha says, what is ignorance, Venerable Sir? The Buddha says, ignorance is the lack of knowledge that what really exists out in the world is collections of energy. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. So I didn't talk much about anicca, dukkha, and anatta today, but without saying those words, I have explained to you what anicca, dukkha, and anatta represent. I've just not dropped the words. That's all. But if you can understand that something is merely collections, aggregations, skandhas of energy, then you must understand that there are no objects here. This is merely energy that has no bias, but has aggregated because there was a necessity. We've talked about this, right? There's a necessity, and that necessity attracts energy into the various formations, and the structure of that formation is also determined by that necessity, and that's why it takes that shape and no other shape. Yeah? And then finally, anatta is, well, that is all there is. There is no object, there is no thing, there is no entity. Now, this is good knowledge. So anything else would be what? Bad knowledge. In other words, ignorance. So when the mind is ignorant, the mind tends to think of the world as not being anicca dukkha anatta, but nitya sukha atta. What does that mean? What that means is, this energy is inherently enveloping. That this is inherently an envelope. Now it's a broken envelope. That is what the mind, that is what ignorance is. To think that this is inherently an envelope, not a mere arrangement of energy that manifests an envelope, but rather that it's inherently an envelope. And therefore now this is a broken envelope. So remember earlier I said the plane is then should technically be a broken envelope and the envelope should be the broken plane. That's how the mind thinks because of ignorance. So whatever it is, the mind inherently takes it as that. Do you see how this is where the sense of belonging comes in? And ownership? See, whose cap is this? This pen's cap. How wrong could you be? How come this cap is this pen's cap? Why does the mind think that way? It's because this energy is inherently this pen. It belongs to the pen. It is the pen. That's how the mind thinks. That is because of ignorance. Ignorance, what ignorance? Nitya, Sukha and Atta. Anicca, Dukkha and Anatta go completely and entirely against this. It's a mirror image of that. It's actually the complete opposite of that. So what happens then? When the mind is ignorant, the mind has now a wish to experience the world in that way. Now the mind is conditioned to experience the world as being Nitya Sukha Atta, meaning to see the world, to perceive entities. As a result of that, there comes attachment. This is the attachment to perceive entities. But are there entities? What is there? Arrangements. An arrangement is not an entity. You get that? An arrangement is not an entity. An arrangement is anything but an entity. But when the mind thinks that the world is full of entities, that is ignorance, out of that comes the attachment to perceive these entities. But here's the problem, ladies and gentlemen. Although the mind has this desire, do we have any entities to present to the mind? Are there any entities in this world to present to the mind? To say, hey, you want entities? Here you go. Are there anything like that to present to the mind? Why isn't there anything like that? Why don't we have anything like that? Because there are no entities. Simple as that. Well, what is there then? Arrangements of energy. That's all there is. But the mind asks for what now? Entities. And there aren't any to provide it with. Therefore, what happens? If you keep asking for something that cannot be given to you, like when you were a kid, you looked up at the moon and said, can I have that, please? And then you know, your mother, your brother, your father, whoever said, no, shut up, you can't have the moon, man. But if you were determined to have the moon, what happened then? Fuss and vexation. Exactly what goes on here. It's exactly what goes on here. See, the mind wants what? Entities. Are there entities to provide? No. But the mind doesn't give up. The mind still wants entities. Therefore, it keeps on begging for it. It cannot be provided. Therefore, what comes next is vexation. To the point where vexation gets the better of it. It's like that pressure cooker. There's only so much pressure that a pressure cooker can handle. At one point, you either release the nozzle or you will have evidence of what was cooking all over the kitchen. That's what happens to the mind, ladies and gentlemen. You've seen people go insane, haven't you? Insane people. I mean, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but when the mind goes insane, right? It's illogical, irrational what people do after that. If you go to the mental hospital, you will see people who've gone insane. And there are some people who walk backwards because they've gone insane. There are some people who drive around like this. And, you know, they're not kids. They'll drive around and go, oh. They do that. Again, I don't mean in disrespect, but that's what happens when the mind goes insane. It creates the reality that it always desired. For, I don't know, for whether it's a curse or a blessing. It's really hard to say. Whether it's a blessing or curse. You know, one could say, isn't that a blessing? Well, yeah, because you know, the mind really wanted something, it couldn't have it, then it ends up creating it. But is it also not a curse? Because now you're seeing a reality that does not exist. No one else agrees with you. Therefore, the only place where you can end up safe is in the mental hospital, mental asylum. So you think they're crazy. And you're not. What do you think goes on inside you? What do you want? Entities. What's available? Collections of energy. You keep asking for it. Nothing to provide you with. Then you start vexing. And when vexation keeps on building and building and building and building, there comes a point where the mind can no longer bear that, says that state of vexation. And at that point, ladies and gentlemen, this goes from vexation to abhisankara, which is the Pali term. Essentially what that means is you go. Yeah. You go insane. That mind goes insane. The reality that it wanted to experience, because it's unavailable, not there to give it, not there to be presented with, the mind goes insane. And then it fabricates the reality that it wants to experience. That fabrication is called bhava. You heard that word? Bhava. It features in the paticca samuppada. Bhava. The mind fabricates this artificial reality. Mental cognition. This is a phantom. A cognitive phantom. It creates that in the mind. So it's kind of like a wrapper. The final stage is what we call jati. This is the point where this creation, this fabrication becomes an experience. It's like you make a hat, but the final point you put it on. If you can make the reference there, right? So here, you, up to this point, you make the hat, you weave the hat, and finally put the hat on. That's what happens at the state of jati. Now, what was there to be presented with, the mind with? Collections of, arrangements of energy. And that's all that could be presented to the mind. So the mind was born to perceive an arrangement of energy. However, this process happens on a bed of ignorance. And it followed this process till the point where you ended up with jati. So now, this is not just a chitta that perceives arrangements of energy, but it also has jati working on it. Therefore, this arrangement of energy goes from a mere arrangement of energy to an entity. So this entity wrapper falls on to this perception. And then finally, it is no longer perceived as a mere collection of energy, but now it's perceived as a thing. This is where things are born. Where are things born? In your minds. Things don't exist in the outside world. Neither living things nor non-living things. They don't exist in the outside world. But what do we teach our children? What does the science book say? Grade 3, what does it say? In this world, dear children, there are living things and non-living things. Feeding what? Yes. Ignorance. So what do teachers do? No, let's not talk about it. See what a predicament this is. What a plight you are in. Now the moment this becomes, this arrangement of energy becomes an entity, they become things. And on things you put set expectations. That's why you expect something out of everything you interact with. That's why you can't not expect this pen to write. You can't not expect that. You are vulnerable to this. A simple pen, a button on your shirt can ruin your day. Why? Because if it's a button, you expect it to behave like a button. Don't you? When you tie your laces, what do you expect them to be? Remain tied. You expect to remain tied. Because they are a lace. So therefore you expect that. How can you not expect? Because jati is going on in your mind all the time. So how can you not? You're a victim. You're vulnerable to this. So why are there fights at home? Why can't you be happy with your husband or your wife? Expectations. Where do these expectations occur? In your mind. Your husband is not a husband. Well, I know you agree with me on that. But even on a serious note, your husband is not a husband. It's merely a collection of energy. And that collection of energy manifests characteristics. That's all it is. But when you entify that bundle, that collection of energy, what happens in your mind? You perceive a husband. And once you perceive a husband, now you set a whole bunch of expectations because husbands are worth setting expectations on. Or at least you think. And then what happens? You are now in moha. Then you either go to raga or desha. Whose fault is that? Apparently whose fault is that? This. But really whose fault is that? See? When you turn the ignition on the car, what do you expect to happen?
Start.
Why? Because that's what it's supposed to do, right? It's supposed to behave like the ignition, like the key. That's what you expect of it. Can you name one thing on which you don't set an expectation? Can you? You can't, isn't it? Because your whole life is based on a whole bunch of expectations. That's why you suffer. I'm here to convince you of this fact and show you that there's no escape. I mean, I think I've proven my point. Unless you come out of raga, dvesha, moha, there's no escape for you. If you can find another, you know, an alternative way out of this trap, you come and let me know. I'm all ears. I'm always open-minded. I'm willing to learn. That's why you can't not set expectations on your children. That's why you can't not set expectations on your glasses. You expect them to be able to see, to let you see. That's why you can't not set expectations on your mother, your father, your brothers, your sisters, your spouses, your friends. All this. That's why you can't not set expectations on the switch. When you flick it, you expect the light to come on. You can't do it without expectation. Why not? Because you've already lost. How can you let this process, keep this process running and then expect to not have expectations? I mean, that is crazy. To have the expectation process running and then to expect for there not to be expectations.
See, this is why I say, you know, you can read all the positive thinking books there are. Right? In all these philosophical books and literature and all there is, you can go to all the seminars and the talks and they'll tell you, don't set expectations. But how? How can you not? Because it's not you who's setting them. You're not the one who's doing it. It's cause and effect. For as long as the mind is ignorant, there's always going to be attachment. For as long as there's attachment, there's going to be vexation. And for as long as there's going to be vexation, there's going to be abhisankara. And then there's going to be bhava. And there's going to be jati. And then you're going to entify every blooming thing that comes into your field of experience. And the result of that, you're in more. Then expectation land. And then you either go into raga or dvesha. So how are you going to not set expectations on things? Isn't that absurd? Natthi me saranam anyam. Buddha me saranam vada. My task is that, to come here and to convince you Colombians that the Buddha is your only refuge. You can look elsewhere, but you won't find. The Dhamma is your only refuge. The Sangha is your only refuge. You can look elsewhere, but you won't find. Nothing else is a remedy. Are you convinced? Because I'm trying really hard to get the point across to you. It's a struggle and a half, ladies and gentlemen, to try and find the words to explain these things, to bring the props to get the message across to you. I don't want anything else in exchange for any of this. I just want you to be convinced, that's all, that the Buddha is the only refuge. I'm an agent of the Buddha. That's all. If you are convinced that there is no other solution than the Buddha, his teaching, and the practice. If you are convinced of that, then my job is done. I need not come here again. Now don't say I'm not convinced. But are you convinced that if you ever want to find happiness in life, you cannot do that when you interact with these entities that you perceive? And you cannot do that unless you free your mind of this ignorance. Because where ignorance lies, attachment lies. Where attachment lies, vexation's there. Where vexation lies, abhisankara happens, because it's not you who does it. It happens. It's a process. Processes are not done by anyone. They happen. One thing leads to the next. And then where that happens, bhava and jati happens. That happens in your mind right now. That's why when you look at me, you think I'm a monk. Therefore, you expect me to behave like one. So when I behave according to your set expectations, you like me. He's a good monk. We like that monk. But if I did anything that goes against your set expectations, then you will not like me anymore. You will dislike me, because I then go into the dvesha side of your expectation setting scenarios. That's why I have to be very careful as to how I conduct myself in your presence. Because you set expectations. I'm not the one who suffers as a result of that. You do. But I, out of compassion, have to ensure that my conduct does not hurt you. Because if you find yourself always in the dvesha side, meaning you set expectations on the Swami Mahansa and he keeps on breaking those expectations, disappointing those expectations, and you will decide, he's an unvirtuous Swami Nansi. What kind of Swami Nansi is that? Not going to come to the sermons anymore. And what happens then? You kick your own bags. That's like shooting yourself in the foot. Therefore, I must always conduct myself properly and maintain that decorum. That's why the Buddha has given us a code of conduct. He says, when you're at the monastery, chill. It's in the books. It is. I'm not making this stuff up. But he says, treat your disciples, your students, the devotees, the upasakas and upasakas' minds as being very fragile. Therefore, be very compassionate towards them. Out of compassion, conduct yourself in a way that aligns with the expectations of a monk. Therefore, when you walk outside, don't go looking around, up, down, left, right, center, and so on. Keep your eyes down. Look at the ground. No more than 2 feet. See? This is the code of conduct that he gives us. Why? To ensure that your minds, you're not hurt, you're not offended, and your expectations are not disappointed. Your expectations are not broken. Therefore, you will come back again to the sasana, to the Dhamma, seeking your own refuge. This is like the mother who has to keep herself well fed so that the child can continue to nurse on her. The mother does that out of compassion. The mother doesn't need it. The mother takes supplements, additional supplements during the time that she nurses her child. Why? It's for the child. The day you tell me, Swami Nasa, I will never be disappointed about the sasana because I have realized that sasana is this. My mind can never be swayed against the sasana anymore. I am steadfast in the sasana. The day that you can come to that firm standing in the sasana, I no longer need to worry about whether my conduct will offend you. But let's always assume that there was always one person in this room who might be, not you, someone else. And therefore, Swami Nansi will always conduct himself in a very proper manner. That is why we have a code of conduct for the most part. You understand? But do you at least understand that you live a life full of moha, expectations, and then you shift to raga and dvesha? There you go. So, there's only one refuge then, ladies and gentlemen, the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha. The Noble Triple Gem is your only blessing. Come forth and seek that blessing and free yourselves from suffering once and for all. Free yourselves from expectation, therefore free yourselves from desire and free yourselves from aversion. Raga keo, desha keo, moha keo, nibbana. That is nibbana. Right, let's leave it there. I have one tiny request. I expected to finish this sermon much sooner than this, but as always, I'm the worst person at keeping time. I have to be out by 12:30, which is in about another 45 minutes for today, because I have to be somewhere else soon. So if you wouldn't mind, please support Swami Nansi's request by doing what you have to do and by not doing what you don't have to do. Okay? All right, let's do the merit transfer and bring today's sermon to a close. First and foremost, let us take a moment to transfer merits that we have all acquired by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, by chanting, by listening to the Dhamma, inviting the Swami Nansi to deliver the sermon, contemplating the Dhamma and reflecting on the profound truths that have been uttered. First and foremost, let us transfer this message to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasakas who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down to the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us transfer these mace to the Mahanayakas, the Anuganika Theras, as well as all the monks and nuns resident in your local town and village, and who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this mace to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also transfer this mace to the devotees, the Upasakas and Upasikas, that is all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as pass on your know-how and continue to extend your well wishes. May they all rejoice in this medicine, by the power of these medicines, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nirvana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers and our employees, our teachers, friends, and anyone and everyone who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. Let us transfer this message to all of them, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nirvana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life and practice the path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer this message to the Sakadeva as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed to fulfill the Samudhasasana and preserve the Samudhasasana. By the power of this message, may they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nirvana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us transfer this message to our forefathers, our ancestors, as well as those who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, members of the armed forces as well as the police force. Let us also transfer this message to those who lost their lives in the natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fire floods, pandemics and so on, reminding ourselves that in this long journey of samsara, they will all have been parents to us, siblings to us, friends of ours, and supported us in many ways and shapes and forms, and therefore with a sense of compassion, loving kindness, as well as a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us. Let us transfer all these merits to them, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nirvana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we will to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a rahatan mahanse or an arahatiranin mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you. Raga Mm-hmm.
sapalaleva nivan sapalaleva tunuruvange soosi ananta maha guna belena siva loka siva satyam nibbana parama sukhaya sukhita tarvatva sadhu sadhu sadhu.